Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, I'll talk with investigative reporter Lee Rood of the Des Moines Register about her recent reporting on allegations of abuse and possible constitutional violations at the youth home Clarinda Academy in southwest Iowa. Also, a new report ranks Iowa as having the fourth highest rate in the country for child deaths in vehicle crashes. We'll learn why and what can be improved on this from the director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. The first day of the Iowa legislative session is 45 days away, and this week the chairs of the House and Senate committees were decided by their respective party caucuses. Here with me now to preview the upcoming session and talk about the issues that the House and Senate committees may focus on is political analyst Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Emily.
So before we dig into these committees, let's remind ourselves about the control of the legislature, because this past election, the Republicans retained control of the Iowa House and Senate. And of course, Governor Kim Reynolds is in the governor's seat, which gives them the ability to continue their agenda for the next 2 years. What do you see as major priorities for GOP lawmakers in the upcoming session?
Well, I think you're right that it's very important to remind everyone that Republicans still have unified control of state government and will through this session as well as the 2020 session. You know, as far as the agenda goes, I think, you know, that's something that party leaders are currently thinking about. They're working with Governor Reynolds on. You know, they've expanded their majority in the Iowa Senate to now holding 32 of the 50 seats. In the Iowa House, their majority is at 54-46. And I think, you know, as they're going forward, they're making some political calculations alongside those policy calculations. Because if you think about what the next 2 years might hold for Republicans, they have this legislative session and then the 2020 legislative session. And after that, everything could potentially change in terms of control of the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate. Now, given their margins in the Iowa Senate, you know, that's a tougher switch for the Democrats. But certainly they're majority in the Iowa House narrowed by 5 seats this past election cycle. And, you know, you go forward, you look forward to the 2020 election. That's a presidential election year. That's a different electorate because you have generally a more diverse electorate showing up, an increase in turnout. And so there's a chance that their unified control could change after that. And so I think for Republicans right now, back to your question on what are they thinking about in terms of policy, I think they're looking at their agenda and trying to probably push through whatever is remaining on their agenda this legislative session. This is a non-election year legislative session, and so typically if there's anything controversial you want to push through, this would be the time to do it. You don't want to carry that over into an election year in 2020, particularly given the narrower majority that they have in the Iowa House. And so, you know, they're going to be looking at things related to tax cuts. We've heard Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitford talk about continuing on tax cuts. We've heard Governor Reynolds talk about continuing with tax cuts for the state. So I expect that to probably be the number one agenda item for this upcoming legislative session. You know, beyond that, there are still some, obviously they're going to be dealing with the budget and, you know, continuing to deal with the budget, waiting for the latest estimates from the Revenue Estimating Conference as they go into the January session. They'll get more estimates in December. And so, I think those two things are probably going to be a big part of what they're talking about. And, you know, beyond that, we all know that, you know, Medicaid is going to continue to be an issue. Funding for education is going to continue to be an issue, that per pupil, the increase for K-12 education, what that's going to look like this year. That's received a lot of attention over the last several years, going back to the Branstad administration when Governor Reynolds was lieutenant governor at the time. There was, you know, I think Democrats had grown kind of accustomed to that, and the state, I think, had grown accustomed to kind of that roughly 2% increase. That dropped a little bit below that in some of the tight budget years during the Branstad administration. So there'll be arguments over that, whether or not that gets back up to 2%. But I think more generally for the Republicans, it's going to be to what extent can they finish off whatever agenda they've had in mind since they took over unified control of the Iowa legislature in following the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Medicaid, K-12 education. Of course, one of the bigger GOP accomplishments last session, the state tax cuts. Mm-hmm. What about other notable legislation from the past few years, like the taking away of collective bargaining rights from public employees? We saw tighter restrictions on abortions and some, you know, pretty sweeping changes to Iowa's firearm laws. Do you think we'll see any of these issues expanded on?
It's hard to say. I think if they're going to do anything further with some of the social issues, more of those hot button issues, I think, you know, this would probably be the session to expect it. I think, you know, something like traffic cameras is still somewhat undecided, and the Iowa Supreme Court has had to get involved with that issue. And so there may be more of a push on traffic cameras, and there may be some more kind of movement around the edges or movement around the margins on abortion policy or gun rights policies. But that was pretty significant legislation that went through last year. And so, you know, I don't know if it's going to be as big of a change going into this year. On collective bargaining, you know, I thought going into the 2018 election cycle that that would be kind of the fundamental issue, but it turned out not to be, I think, in part because most of the recertification for a lot of the unions across the state were upheld. And so we didn't really see that breaking apart of unions. So I don't know if there'll be much movement on that. But I wouldn't be surprised to see some movement on some social issues.
Mm-hmm. The GOP has a lead, a 32-18 margin over Democrats in the Senate. And you mm-hmm. mentioned the 54-46, slightly smaller margin in the House. What role do you think we're likely to see Democrats play over the course of the session?
Well, it's difficult because I think, you know, they're going to be pushing back. They're going to be trying to block legislation. They really can't as the minority party. But I think you're going to see them standing up on certain issues, trying to stop certain issues and trying to set the agenda and set the election year agenda for 2020 in terms of what they're going to stand for going into the 2020 election cycle. Because they can't really block anything in their role as minority party, but they can start to introduce proposals that they can use when they go on the campaign trail in 2020 to say, hey, we introduced this or we introduced this, we tried to change this, but these were issues that were blocked by the Republicans in control. And so I think you're going to continue to hear them talk about what they see as the damaging effects of the state tax cuts that went through last year. I think you're going to continue to hear Democrats talk about issues with the Medicaid privatization, talk about individual cases with that. I think you're going to continue to see Democrats talk about funding levels for K-12 education as well as higher education, and that more money needs to be spent there, and you know, introducing their own proposals on those three issues.
I'm talking with Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, getting a preview of the 2019 legislative session. Let's talk a little bit about leadership. So mm-hmm. the Senate president will be Republican Senator Jack Whitaker of Ankeny, and House Speaker will be Representative Linda Uppmeyer, a Republican from Clear Lake. Not a big change to Senate and House leadership here.
No, there isn't. And these are, as you said, not a big change. These are two individuals who have experience leading their caucuses in each chamber. And so, you know, you wouldn't expect any issues there going into this session.
What do we know about the minority leaders for 2019?
Well, the minority leaders, we know that it's changed in the Iowa House. Representative Todd Pritchard from Charles City is going to lead the minority party in the 2019 legislature. We also know that there are some new assistant minority leaders. We have Brian Meyer of Des Moines, Sharon Steckman of Mason City, Wes Breckenridge of Newton, John Forbes of Urbandale, and Joel Oldson of Des Moines is the new Democratic whip. And so some new leadership there for the House Democrats. And again, it'll be interesting to see on what issues did they really try to take a strong stand and make their case for why they think for what they see as the state maybe moving in the wrong direction on some key issues. And again, I expect it would be on issues like tax cuts, Medicaid, education funding.
Mm-hmm. So committee chairs were decided this week by the parties. Mm-hmm. Since Republicans are in control of the House and the Senate, will they be in control of most of the committees?
Yes, they'll have control of the House and Senate committees. And of course, those are obviously going to be extremely important to each particular issue area. But again, the overall agenda is going to be set by the caucus leaders for the Republican Party with Senator Jack Whitaker and, as you mentioned, Speaker Uppmeyer. So, you know, but the Republicans will be controlling those committee chairs. They'll be controlling the House and the appropriations subcommittees, the House and Senate subcommittees. And so all of that will be under Republican control. And again, that's their chance to set their agenda or finish off whatever agenda they see that they want to push through before we get in, as I said, probably before we get into the 2020 session.
Mm-hmm. The Ways and Means Committee was pretty instrumental in last year's, you know, large income tax cut. I think it was the largest income tax cut in state history. What kind of tax reform can we expect to see coming out of both the House and Senate's Ways and Means Committees this year, next year?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on what Governor Reynolds is going to want to do. Does she want to continue to push forward with cutting taxes for state taxes for individual state taxes for Iowa taxpayers? Does she want to continue to push forward with tax cuts for businesses in the state? And if she does, then those proposals are going to work their way through those two committees.
Mm-hmm. After signing the water quality bill last year, Governor Reynolds said that the water quality discussion isn't over. What committees handle the issue of water quality? I could expect that that would maybe go across several of committees in the legislature.
Yeah, you would expect, and it'll depend on kind of what the changes are there. If they're revenue changes, if you're talking about more funding for, or if you're talking about a redirection of funds, this could get into appropriations. You would certainly expect it to be in the House Environmental Protection committees. The agricultural committees, the agricultural and natural resources appropriation subcommittees. I mean, I think there are several committees or subcommittees, as you said, that could potentially deal with this water quality issue. It'll just depend on what the actual bill looks like.
Do you think we'll see more on that issue?
I certainly think the issue will be raised. I think, again, it's going to depend a little bit on what the overall budget picture looks like for the state, what the latest estimates from the Revenue Estimating Conference look like as they come out in December, and how that shapes the legislative session. And then, of course, again, those estimates come out in March as well during the session. So I think that, in part, will shape what the legislature and what Republicans decide to do beyond tax cuts, health care, education funding.
Mm-hmm. Any committee leader appointments, any other committee leader appointments that really stood out to you?
No, not particularly. And it's a little bit hard to know if any one of these individual legislators has a particular agenda that they're going to try to push, because they are going to be really under the direction of the caucus leaders. As I said, the Senate Majority Leader and Jack Whitfer, and the Speaker of the House, Linda Upmeyer, they are really going to direct the agenda, and they're going to direct what is debated on the floor. It's very similar to what you see at the federal level in the U.S. Congress, where you have the Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House really controlling the agenda.
All right, we have 45 days until the Iowa legislature reconvenes. What else are you going to be looking for leading up to the next session?
I think just trying to get a sense of what are going to be the primary issues. Every year it's harder and harder to make a prediction about what is going to matter, what is going to be the key issues, because there's always something that seems to come up that is really sort of out of left field, you really didn't expect or you really didn't see coming. And there are, of course, any sort of events that happen can potentially impact what the state legislature does. It could be a budgetary event in terms of revenue estimates. It could be, something beyond anyone's control, whether, hopefully not, but, a natural disaster or something else. Those things can affect what the legislature does, what the legislature sees as a priority. So that makes it hard to make a prediction. And like I said, every session, it seems like there's always something that comes up that you really just didn't see coming.
Chris Larimer is a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris W. Larimer. Chris, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Emily.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. A new report from Safewise, a website that tracks and compares safety and security data, has ranked Iowa as having the fourth highest rate in the country for children dying in vehicle crashes. This study looked at crash data from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration and child safety seat laws from the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety. And according to the report, an average of nearly 4 children out of 100,000 die in vehicle collisions each year in Iowa. Here with me now to provide some context on this report is the director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa, Dan McGeehy. Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
Hey, Emily. How are you?
So, Dan, to be frank, this report kind of surprised me, because having lived and traveled in other areas of the country, my anecdotal experience is that kind of Iowa drivers are a bit safer and a little bit less risky on the road than drivers in other states, as far as, traveling the speed limit, not cutting people off. So were you surprised to hear the details of this report on children and vehicle crashes in Iowa?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at the broader context, like you said, and that is that in Iowa, and when you look at some of these statistics, they're not necessarily always inside the car. So some of the data that are presented in this report actually include children pedestrians that were hit and killed as well. But the broader context is really that Iowa is one of the few states that doesn't have a rear safety belt law. So up until you're 20 pounds, you have to be rear facing, according to Iowa law, and then you have to be in a booster seat until age 6. But after age 6, you're pretty much free to roam around the back seat. There isn't any law. There's no really education around that. And this is really where we see a problem in crashes, where children are unrestrained, and even adults that are unrestrained. And those of us that study crashes every day, it's a really big problem. In Iowa, you are killed on a rural road when you depart the road and go into a ditch. And this is where we see ejections. And then even, you know, you become a projectile in a crash, and you hit the front passengers when you get into a collision as well.
Mm. So clarify that a little bit more. So if you're over age 6, do you need to wear a seatbelt in the back seat?
Not in Iowa. And and so this is a problem. And this is something that we'd really like to see the legislature change those laws.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any pushback on that? Or is this just something that's kind of been overlooked in our state over the years?
There's been several attempts to add an all-passenger seatbelt law. And I think there'll be another attempt this year to move forward with that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think are kind of stricter punitive measures helpful in changing people's behavior while driving? You know, you get a fine if you don't have, you know, a child in a seatbelt or that sort of thing. Or, you know, what's the best way to go about that?
Like anything, that's really about a number of different modalities that we look at. So education is certainly a very important one. And for children, it's kind of confusing because while we have a pretty good child safety seat usage rate in Iowa, across the board, they're not necessarily installed correctly. So you might have a child in a safety seat, but the safety seat needs to be installed correctly. And this is my colleagues in the College of Public Health, Dr. Kara Hammond, has done a lot of work in this area, Dr. Corey Peek-Asa, John Landell before that, and found that people really, the seats themselves, they might be occupied and belted, but they're not connected to the vehicle. And this is really where getting your vehicle inspected by a certified child safety seat person, whether it's here at the fire station, your local fire station, very important to make sure that seat is really locked down in there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I thought this was interesting relating to children's safety seats. The Cedar Rapids Police Department recently warned people that in the winter, bulky coats can lead to a child not being secured properly. So how do you check for that? Have you heard about this?
Yes, this is a big issue. And even in regular seat belts, when we get into our cars and we have that big down coat, the lap belt might ride up over your stomach and not keep flat against your lap. But no, this is a really big issue with children. And it's hard because when it's cold out, you want them to be warm. But what happens in a crash, when you have the seat belts around you in a safety seat, it leaves a much more movement. So when you get into that impacts, and impacts are very violent. It's not like on television we see this big, huge pillow come out from the airbag. But the more movement, you need to be strapped in as tight as possible. What the coat does is allow sort of movement outside of that. And you can actually slip out of a belt in a crash.
Hmm. Okay. And I've also heard that, you know, car seats can expire. And, you know, lots of parents, you know, if they have multiple kids, they use kind of hand-me-down car seats. And I've heard that that can pose a risk. What does the data say about that?
Yeah, so anytime you're in any kind of crash, for instance, the seat should be replaced because any kind of impact can put a crack that you can't see in there. And then older car seats that are, you'll see a date that's stamped on the back of every car seat. Once it gets to about 7, 8, 9 years old, the plastics start to break down. Because think about here in Iowa, it's super hot in that car in the summertime. It gets really cold. Plastic gets brittle. Foam begins to break down. So it's really shouldn't be looked at as an economic issue. You should really have an up-to-date car seat as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And is there any place to go to check if you have the most up-to-date car seat? Are there resources available?
Yeah, there are a number of online resources. You can look at Consumer Reports. The University of Michigan does a lot of that crash testing. But if you just go online and sort of Google child safety seat ratings, you'll find a lot of information online.
Mm-hmm. The Iowa State Patrol recently responded to nearly 100 vehicle accidents in less than 24 hours. This was this past Sunday when we had winter storms coming in portions of southern and eastern Iowa. And actually, there have been several crash-related fatalities on Iowa roads this week. You know, perennial discussion, winter driving, what can we do to be safer? We need to be reminded.
Well, first off, buckle up. I think this is, you know, we study all sorts of amazing technologies for the last 25 years here at the University of Iowa, but the seatbelt is still the best thing that you can do is strap in. All positions. We kind of forget about the people in the back seat sometimes, but make sure every time you drive, if you have a person in the back seat, that they're buckled up and that their shoulder belt is on. One thing that we see in crashes is that people want to lean forward so they can hear better and they'll move that shoulder belt away. That's a really critical error. So when you get into a crash and you just have a lap belt on and it goes over your belly, that's when you get those really bad internal injuries. So that shoulder belt's very important to help distribute the energy.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, but I want to ask you about the National Advanced Driving Simulator's collaboration with the Iowa Department of Transportation. So you're working on a council to get Iowa ready for automated vehicles. Tell me about that.
Yes, the Iowa DOT has an automated vehicle council, and we're leading the logistics of that. In fact, we just met yesterday. In Des Moines, largely made up of people from the governor's cabinet, from insurance, public safety, Department of Transportation. Our colleagues at Iowa State University, Shauna Hallmark and Neil Hawkins, are leading the infrastructure side of that. We tend to specialize more on the vehicle safety part. But Iowa has been doing automated vehicle research for over 25 years now. And so now we're really trying, we're getting to the point of getting the players together in the state and to make some important policy decisions. We're not going to have robots driving down the road in the next 10 or 20 years yet, but we still need to be ready.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll have to check back in with you about that. Dan McGeehee, Director of the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa here in Iowa City. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Emily.
We need to take a quick break. Coming up in the second half of today's show, my conversation with Des Moines Register watchdog columnist Lee Rood. We'll talk about what she's uncovered in her investigation of the Southwest Iowa foster care facility, Clarinda Academy, where there have been reports of physical and verbal abuse, excessive restraint, and sex crimes perpetrated by caretakers. That's all coming up after a news update from IPR's Dennis Reese. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Back in just a moment. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. This October, a report by Disability Rights Washington showed that out-of-state foster children living at Clarinda Academy in Southwest Iowa were physically abused, with possible violations to their constitutional rights. Specifically, the report said that foster children were being held against their will, were subjected to excessive restraint and segregation, and experienced verbal and physical abuse. And the report has led the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families to say it will actually stop placing children there and will begin taking students out starting in January. With me now to share details from the report and provide some updates on this story is Lee Rood, investigative reporter and Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. Hi, Lee.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. So before we begin, give us an idea of the students who are at Clarinda Academy.
So these are all troubled youth. Clarinda, the for-profit company that runs Clarinda Academy, focuses on kids in the foster care system. Most of these kids are from out of state, about two-thirds of them, and about 50 from Iowa. And they're all troubled and have sort of behavior and possibly delinquency issues coming in.
So, Lee, tell me about some of the experiences of students at the facility.
Well, so when I look at facilities like this, one of the first things that I do is take a look at the police incident reports to that facility. And at Clarinda, I looked at 5 years' worth of reports. What we saw were a series of assaults of staff on the students who lived there, student-on-student assaults, sexual abuse involving staff members and students who lived there at Clarinda.
And so tell me about a few of those police reports that you obtained about fights and even allegations of forcible sodomy and rape by staff members. What are some examples?
One of the cases that I followed up on after the initial story this week was the case of a troubled teenager there who, even before arriving at Clarinda, had been twice the victim of sexual assault, had also attempted suicide on multiple occasions. Her mother wanted to check and make sure that no men were working in the dorm where she would be living at Clarinda. And she says that employees told her none were. And when her when her daughter arrived there, she was sexually assaulted by a man who happened to be a convicted felon from California. He was supposed to be a counselor at Clarinda, but had, I'm told, no experience working with youth as a counselor.
And do we know how he came to be working at the facility?
Well, state law does not require, or I should say, does not prohibit convicted felons from working in licensed foster care facilities. But Sequel, the owner of Clarinda Academy, is required by state law to do background checks on their employees. And this man, I'm told, did disclose this on his job application, and they hired him anyway.
Mm-hmm. And your investigation shows that actually many of the perpetrators of these reports went uncharged.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, that's kind of one of the troubling things about these kinds of centers in general in Iowa. You see in police reports really serious allegations, and it's hard to determine sometimes just how much serious investigating took place. We certainly saw that with Midwest Academy, the boarding school down in Keokuk that was shuttered and investigated by the state. And Clarinda is licensed and inspected by state officials, but that is sort of limited, and that's sort of a issue for debate coming up probably at the legislature this year.
Mm-hmm. And from reading your reporting, it sounds like when kind of checks on the facility were being done, everything looked okay, but then actually in private conversations with some of the students is when many of these things came out.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's part of the problem, is that this is by nature a very troubled population of kids, and a lot of incidents would probably happen regardless, but it's just how do you monitor such a vulnerable population, and how much expertise really should you have among employees who work for those kinds of facilities?
Mm-hmm. An update on this story, the owners of Clarinda Academy, who you mentioned, I believe it's called Sequel, it's a privately owned company based out of Alabama. The owners now face a civil trial after hiring the convicted felon you mentioned who sexually assaulted a student at the facility. Tell me about this lawsuit.
So the lawsuit is scheduled to go to trial right now, April 23rd. It was filed last November against Clarinda Academy and the employee who is alleged to have committed the sexual assault. He was actually convicted of one crime last year related to that sexual assault. His name's Antonio Aranda. And it seeks damages for the trauma that the girl suffered as a result of the sexual assault and her being sort of restrained in her room with Aranda when she was living there. She's now 19 and living back in Texas.
And beyond that case, the reports that you mentioned that went uncharged, do you think any of those will come into the legal system and be addressed at some point?
It's hard to know. Right now, the The State Departments of Human Services and Inspection and Appeals are both looking into some of the allegations raised by Disability Rights Washington. And DHS officials have said that corrective steps will be taken if they find further problems, but that's really sort of from the licensing standpoint. I couldn't get a clear read from local law enforcement on how much some of these other crimes were being pursued. So it's hard to know.
Mm-hmm. The Disability Rights Washington report mentioned that the constitutional rights of students were being violated at the facility. Do we know yet what that argument entails?
Well, I mean, these are kids with disabilities, and so they were saying that some of the things that you mentioned, the excessive restraint and seclusion, violated not only the Americans with Disability Act, but also the Disabilities Education Act. It's certainly not the first time that disability rights groups have alleged this at residential homes like this around the country. Their primary interest is in getting these troubled youth into the least restrictive environments possible. But it's hard to know right now what will happen at Clarinda Academy and its sort of sister facility, Woodward Academy, which is also owned by Sequel.
Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate, Sequel is a privately owned company based out of Alabama. I believe it's it has schools kind of nationwide, and Clarinda Academy in southwest Iowa. What action, if any, can the state take? Would it be looking specifically at Clarinda Academy, or are there some more, widespread actions that the state can take to prevent issues like this in the future?
Well, I think that's what lawmakers are looking at right now, and I don't think that they have a clear sense of that just yet. I think it kind of depends on what the state finds, but, you know, when 100 and some of these kids are coming from other states, there's a real limit on how much they're being monitored, and that certainly concerns Disability Rights Washington. The state of Washington has quit sending foster children to Clarinda Academy. One of the questions that we had, certainly in the reporting, is should you have convicted felons working in foster care facilities with this vulnerable population, or should there be more done to assure the right level of expertise when you're talking about kids who often have very serious behavior disorders?
Mm-hmm. We'll be sure to follow your reporting moving forward. Lee Rood is an investigative reporter and Reader's Watchdog columnist at the Des Moines Register. You can follow her reporting on Twitter. Follow her at Lee Rood. That's LEEROOD. Lee, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. After noticing an increase in crimes featuring toy firearms like BB guns and pellet guns, Sioux City officials have rewritten the city's weapon code to prohibit people from carrying such weapons in town. Iowa Public Radio reporter Katie Pikus has been following this story, and she's here with me now. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
So, tell me, what kinds of situations is the city hoping to avoid by updating the city's code? Can you kind of paint a picture of a situation where this would come up?
Yeah, so as you said, you know, the Sioux City Police Department says they've seen an increase in BB guns being used in crime. You know, one example they gave me is a taxi cab was recently robbed in the Morningside neighborhood of Sioux City, and the perpetrator used a BB gun. And at the time, it was believed to be a real gun. So this ordinance is kind of a deterrent on people from carrying these things that look like real guns in the city.
Mm-hmm. And from the picture on your report on our website, I mean, some of these BB guns do, it's very hard to tell the difference between this kind of pellet gun and a handgun. There's a, when we say toy guns, there's not an orange little thing on the tip of the gun. It, you can't tell immediately that it is a toy gun, right?
Exactly. And that's actually why the police department prefers to call these simulated weapons, especially because on the label of the BB gun, it says something like, not a toy, could cause serious injury or death.
Interesting. So BB guns and pellet guns are simulated weapons in this code. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you get the sense from talking with law enforcement? I don't know if they had specific numbers, but how common is it for people to brandish these weapons?
They did not have specific numbers to do that. To be able to put specific numbers together would, you know, take a lot of labor. It would be very labor intensive because they haven't previously tracked that. From what I recall, they had said that having this ordinance in place will now give them, you know, hopefully a tool to track this in the future. So we may know, you know, 6 months, a year down the road or so, you know, how often something like this happens.
Mm-hmm. So specifically, prohibiting people from carrying BB guns and pellet guns in town, what does that mean? What would happen to someone if they were caught carrying a BB gun walking down the street?
Basically, if you're walking down the street and you've got a BB gun in your belt, and again, you know, this looks like a real gun, you know, you'd get a simple misdemeanor, which is a penalty from $65 to $625, or alternatively, you could get 30 days in jail. You know, if you commit a crime like shoplifting and you use a BB gun in that, all of a sudden it becomes a whole other classification, and that's an armed robbery.
Mm. So how does this square with Iowa's permit to carry laws? I'm assuming if you do have a permit to carry a handgun, you're not restricted from carrying a pellet gun. Is that assumption correct?
Right. They've told me if you have a concealed carry permit, you can carry one anywhere you want.
Do we have a sense of what residents think of this code update?
That's an interesting question. I think that's something that I would like to find out in the long run. There were no comments made at the two hearings that I've been to from residents themselves, but I know that the council was very supportive of the ordinance.
I'm talking with Katie Pikus. She's Iowa Public Radio's Western Iowa reporter, and you can follow her reporting on Twitter at Katie Pikus. Katie, you also reported this week on a talk that Representative Steve King gave at a Rotary Club in Sioux City. Now, Representative King received a lot of attention in the weeks and days before this past November's election, you know, for his endorsement of a white nationalist Canadian political candidate, as well as for his comments over the years regarding undocumented immigrants, Muslims, and Dreamers. What was the crowd at the Rotary Club meeting like? Did you get the sense that he was speaking with mostly supporters? Were there any protesters there?
There were three protesters outside who just came because they knew that King was coming to speak to the Rotary Club. The Rotary Club itself was a whole mix of people. I did not get the sense for what party they were all from, but they're all kind of business owners in Sioux City, so a whole mix of people. Some may have been supporters, others may have been opponents, just kind of a whole mix of people there.
Mm-hmm. Being known for his comments, as I mentioned, on immigration, and with the news of migrants seeking asylum at our southern border this week, you know, what sorts of questions did Representative King field on immigration?
The big one that really caught my attention was when a club member asked if the state and the country should be more open to taking in labor from across the borders, you know, especially for Iowa to resolve like Iowa's labor shortages. And King talked about this bill he introduced earlier this year called the E-Bonding for Immigration Integrity Act of 2018, which essentially says that any person coming in would be coming in from outside of the country would be required to post a bond before they're given a visa. And that bond could be anywhere from $2,500 to $10,000.
It looks like Representative King also mentioned the farm bill. What would he like to see included in a new farm bill?
He did. He drafted legislation nearly a decade ago that he talked about that would keep states from kind of regulating other states' production standards for different agricultural products that are sold, you know, between states and interstate commerce. And he says the motivation for that was because California was, quote, locking out Iowa's ethanol.
All right, Katie Pikus, Iowa Public Radio's Western Iowa reporter. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Earlier this hour, we heard from National Advanced Driving Simulator Director Dan McGeehee discussing road safety in Iowa. And I want to issue a quick correction that under Iowa's state law, all children under the age of 18 in the backseat of a vehicle are required to wear safety belts. So again, all children under age 18 in the backseat of their car must wear safety belts under Iowa state law. Well, and to cap off today's show, Iowa Public Radio's senior music producer Mark Simmet is joining me from our Cedar Falls studio to share some music suggestions for the weekend. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Emily. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining me. So it's my understanding that you are all about the holiday tunes this week.
Yeah, I don't think it's too early. You know, yeah. We're past Thanksgiving and we've started adding holiday selections to our music mix on our Studio One shows, including Studio One Tracks. And we just we have had some new holiday music come in to Studio One, including a couple of really nice new albums that came in together very recently. And they're all original songs for the holidays, which is great to see. You know, the old classics are fine, but when somebody actually writes new songs about Christmas and the holidays, that's wonderful. So I thought I'd pick out a couple of those. J.D. McPherson's, his brand new album, J.D. McPherson's new album is called Socks. And it's kind of like his reminiscences about his childhood Christmas memories and so on. Very fun album, retro 1950s R&B rock and roll sound from J.D. McPherson. This one's called What's That Sound?
What's that sound at the door I hear? That same pretty sound last year. Neighbors are caroling around the town, trying to spread a little bit of joy around. I hear that sound make me feel so fine. Sounds a little bit like Christmas time. What's that sound in the street I hear? I heard that same mighty sound last year. Parade drummers marching out two by two, rocking out the holiday boogaloo.
What's J.D. McPherson with What's That Sound? All right, what else do you have for us, Mark?
Yeah, and the second one came in almost exactly at the same time. It was from Rodney Crowell, and his new album is called Christmas Everywhere. It's a bit darker than the J.D. McPherson album, but also falls into that Americana space. Rodney Crowell, of course, had quite a career as a country artist, but his music really encompasses more than just country music. He's got some R&B and rock and roll influences as well. And this is the title song from his new one, Christmas Everywhere.
Christmas, 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 Christmas everywhere. Christmas, 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 pulling out my hair. Shoppers lined up out the door, traffic backed up miles or more. It's Christmas time, so what the heck? Let's go spend the whole paycheck. Christmas, 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 morning, noon, and night. Christmas, 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 am I right? Larry wants a Lincoln Log, Carrie wants a puppy dog, and Johnny wants a...
Kind of reminds me of the first part of the Waitress's Christmas rapping song, just kind of catching the hecticness of the holidays.
Yeah, and a lot of words coming at you, mainly the word Christmas, which he actually has the word Christmas in the title of 9 of the 12 songs. So I don't know if he's making a statement there or what.
No. All right, and I think we have time for one more, Mark.
Yeah, and after I said all that about original songs, this next one is from Los Straitjackets. They have a new collection of all cover songs of your favorite, all the Christmas songs you'd expect, pretty much. They've done a couple of albums over the years. They're from Nashville, great instrumentalists, and kind of a surf-rocking place that they're coming from, but more than that as well. And this is their version of Sleigh Ride, Los Straitjackets.
All right. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Introducing us to some new songs. All right. This is Los Straitjackets, Sleigh Ride. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.